Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to hear from a much younger veteran than usual. In fact, he's younger than I am, but what he went through is so similar to what we've heard from hundreds and hundreds of World War II veterans on this program through the years. Earlier, I read you the Medal of Honor citation for Leroy Petrie, 43 years old and originally from Santa Fe, New Mexico. You can find some of his memorabilia on display at the New Mexico Veterans Memorial in Albuquerque. That's just a few blocks north of Kirtland Air Force Base if you ever visit the Duke City. Or maybe you're one of our longtime listeners right there on affiliate KIVA in the Land of Enchantment. I played for you that sound. That's his prosthetic hand. It's a sound you may hear a time or two during the conversation as he adjusts it. But let's start out with what it means to be one of now just 65 living recipients of our nation's highest military decoration, the Medal of Honor.
You don't have any responsibility. There's some recipients I've never met. Some that after they receive it, they put it in their sock drawer and just went on with their lives. I feel that I've been blessed with the opportunity to use it as a platform to help others. I don't have to do this, but I'm darn lucky I get to, and I see the difference I'm able to make, and my family does as well, and that's why they allow me to be gone so much, as they said, "Dad, we know this is important to you and important to so many others. We'll get time when you are home."
And you've had a chance to meet other recipients of the Medal of Honor.
I have.
What's that like for you? And are there some memories that come to mind of interactions with some of these guys that leave a powerful impression on you?
I think every single one that I've met has left an impression on me. It's an award based on action, not character. So you get all kinds of characters. but it's the same with the military. It's mm-hmm. You come from all different backgrounds and you share stuff. And to be honest, it feels like I'm just with my guys in my platoon. When we're on a bus and they're giving each other a hard time and they're laughing and joking, but they're also there to support one another when they're having a hard time, or visit them when they're ill or in the hospital and checking on one another. You become like family. And I think that was the most important thing to me, was that when I showed up, they welcomed me in like family. I mean, I was the second living recipient since Vietnam, and so there wasn't many of us, and there's today there's still not. But mm-hmm. I also have the honor of, I was elected, I'm the president of the society now, and so they have been supporting us over the years, and I was like, okay, Leroy, it's time to stop being a dirtbag in the background, and these older guys have been doing the leadership the whole time. It's time for us to step up and take the reins and let them get some rest.
Mm-hmm. Before I ask you about your story, is there a guy or two who, hearing their story and what they went through to earn the Medal of Honor, just really grabbed you or moved you?
I don't think a single person. I think they all added to. It's the same way that people will ask me who's the most interesting person that you've met, or the most famous person that you've met, and I think they all contribute. And just like with my story, the hand grenade taking my hand, people will ask, oh, do you regret anything, or would you change anything? I joke, and I said, I wish I would have grabbed that grenade with my left hand, because learning everything over again was not very easy, but I wouldn't change anything, not one thing in my life, because mm-hmm. the good things and the bad things, they all contributed to who I am today. Some of those guys' stories, I don't know every single recipient's story. There's a little over 3,500. Mm-hmm. But I respect their stories, just like when I meet these people and they say, pick one. And I respect whatever platform they've earned, whether it's wealth, fame, money, whatever it is, athletes, whatever. But what I look at more is their character. Okay, you've done this, but who are you today? Mm-hmm. Are you still me person, or are you a good person? Do you have good values? And that's what sets in better with me, and the people that I'll hang around with are people of good character. I started my life hanging around with people of not good character, and I almost failed out of school. And then I luckily realized that I was not only letting my parents down, but my teachers and everyone that supported me. And I stopped hanging around with those bad characters. And I realized from this point on, you're going to surround yourself with good people that support you and positively impact you.
You know, the Medal of Honor is not the only thing you're wearing there. You've got a Ranger pin. And that's a pretty tight-knit fraternity, too. Pretty small group. What does that represent to you? What does that make you feel when you put that on?
To me, it's a discipline. It's leadership. It's the bond of brotherhood. When I joined the military, like I said, I was still not the best yet, but every leader I had was an amazing leader. I only had one leader that wasn't that good, and I learned from him as well. But the discipline that they instill and the challenging environment that you're put into, it's important. And I realize that it's hard because it needs to be. You need to stay vigilant in case of war. It's not a normal job. And there's a reason I tell folks, you stay in long enough, you end up with these receding hairlines because it's stressful. Lives depend on you. And it is a life or death job. It's not like working at Burger King where you forget to put somebody's lettuce on somebody's sandwich and, oh, I'm sorry, we'll fix that. You can't bring those things back where once you train someone and a bullet leaves their barrel, you're responsible for that bullet as much as they are. You try to teach them ethics and to be a good person, but also to be a good soldier. The Ranger Creed was one of those things that I always looked at, and they told me, if you live your life by the Ranger Creed and your decisions you make, you look at the creed, you'll be okay in life. And my drill sergeant in basic training just happened to be the guy who, from the movie Black Hawk Down, was running around making coffee the whole time. It was the actual character from Mogadishu. And he had a 4x8 Ranger Creed on the wall, and as all the other platoons were learning the infantry creed and the soldier creed, he said, men, you don't need to worry about all those other creeds. This is the only one you need to worry about. And as I went through different schools and I looked at the different creeds in the Army, they're basically all derived from the Ranger Creed, and I said, wow, this is where it all started. And historically, that's what they did in World War II. Mm-hmm. They couldn't get up those cliffs, and they looked back at General Norman D. Cota, and he said, Rangers, lead the way. And we've been trying to maintain and hold that standard since then.
I know we can read your citation, and I know that's not the only incident you were involved in your service. I mean,
we all have stories.
Right? Well, whatever you're comfortable with, can you tell us, you know, from your perspective, the story of what happened that day and what you were thinking, how that unfolded, and what that represents to you now?
The day before, Rangers operate during night activities. We don't want to kill every terrorist, put it that way. A live terrorist is worth more than a dead one because dead ones don't talk. Mm-hmm. And so we try to catch them while they're sleeping, and we go at night operations because we had night vision and we had the cover of darkness. Well, this day before our mission, we got alerted. All special operations in theater in Afghanistan, hey, there's a high-value target that's come up on the net that we think's operated in Afghanistan somewhere. Everyone's going to stand down. Whoever is closest to him when he pops up will action on it. And so during the daytime, we normally sleep or we check our email, do laundry, all our other stuff, and go to the gym. But that morning, I woke up and I went to the our planning bay, and there's one officer across the room from me, and he's on his laptop, and I'm checking my email, and all of a sudden he jumps up. Petrie, go wake up the pilots. Didn't even question what it was about. Just ran to go wake up the pilots. Immediately went and woke up my guys as well. I said, hey, something might be going on. Check your kit. Be ready. It's better to be prepared than proactive instead of reactive. Mm-hmm. But as I did that, I went to our chow tent, if you will. And as I walk in there, it's decorated red, white, blue everywhere. And I'm like, what's going on? I get to the end. I was trying to grab a couple of little bags of beef jerky. We got stuck out a couple days before and longer than expected. And morale from the young guys, oh, man, we were supposed to be back already. And you throw them a little bag of beef jerky and it boosts their morale. We call it lickies and chewies. But as I was doing that, as I get to the end of the table, I see the sheet cake and it says Happy Memorial Day. And I'm looking around and I'm like, wow, took a moment of silence. Our up-tempo was so high that, I mean, by the time you look at the date, you're like, man, we've already been over here for 3 weeks or whatever it may be. And after I paid my respects, I ran out the door and immediately told my guys, check their equipment, and we started planning for this mission. The guy actually popped up in our area, and so high-value target, quick mission planning. Next thing we know, we're on three Chinooks headed out to the mission. Rural Afghanistan, a lot of farmland and adobe-type houses and compounds. And as we came off the Chinooks, the other hard part about it is, because we're flying during daylight, you can hear a Chinook helicopter out for miles. And so as we land and the ramp goes down in the back, we're coming out the back, we're taking fire. The guy in the open field, politically correct term, we neutralize the threat. And as we're clearing the body, my platoon leader and I, we hear over the radio that one of our younger squad leaders had gone into the wrong compound and he was correcting it and going across the road. And I said, hey, I'm going to break off, provide overwatch for these guys. And he said, go ahead. As I caught up to that squad, they had already breached the compound wall, which was probably about 20-foot walls. And they were already entering into the compound. I followed in as the last man. As they did, they went across the compound and started clearing a smaller structure in the back corner, kind of a two-story, and it had an inner compound in there. But I didn't even go in. I stopped in the doorway and I said, give me another guy. My big thing in my mind was we needed to clear the rest of this courtyard and the adjacent small building. And so as soon as I got a tap, I didn't even look who was with me. I just knew I had somebody with me and I started to move. It was PFC Robinson. And as we started to cross to this small adjacent building, two guys popped up probably 15, 20 feet to our left, spraying AK-47s from the hip. I got shot in my left thigh, and it felt like a sledgehammer, like somebody just pounded your leg, and kind of looked like a deer when it gets shot on TV where it bucks mid-stride, but then kept running, because mentally I was thinking, get out of the kill zone before you take another hit. Robinson got hit just below his armpit. He didn't know how bad it was. We found out later it was about a quarter of an inch from going over his plates, and it would have hit his heart, his lungs, and he probably would have died there instantly. But he followed me, got behind the small building. This building's only about 7 feet wide, about 6 feet long. And immediately I tell him, hey, watch that corner, do self-aid, and I'm watching this corner. They're shooting around the corner still. And I prepped a grenade, threw it over, it went off, kind of bought us a lull in fire. At that point, Sergeant Higgins, another Ranger, comes running over, and I said, hey, help Robinson, watch that corner. My biggest fear was they were going to come over and around the sides and finish us off while we're injured. And so I get on the radio, I'm giving my command a better picture of what's going on, tell them we still have Rangers in contact, heavy small arms, and two wounded Eagles. And next thing we know, we hear a blast. Two guys next to me look at me and they're like, what the heck was that? And I said, they're throwing grenades. Keep your heads down. Keep watching those corners. So I go back. I'm almost in a crouched seated position because my leg was hurting. I'm checking my side, watching my corner, turning back, checking on them, checking back radio. And on one of my checks to check on them, there was a pineapple grenade that had come over the building and landed right behind them. I knew we hadn't used pineapple grenades in years. It wasn't there before, and so just immediately saw it as a threat and reached out, grabbed it, and as I was throwing it away from our position, as soon as I opened my hand to release it, it exploded. Completely took the hand off, almost like somebody had taken a circular saw and cut it off. I sat up, grabbed it. The radius and the ulna were poking up about a half an inch. It was bleeding pretty, like more like oozing. And the skin was hanging all the way around, short 2-inch skin, flap skirt, so to speak. And in my mind, I was thinking, why isn't this thing spraying 3 feet in the air like in the movies? Blood just squirting. And when reality hit, I said, I know how to take care of this. I grabbed a tourniquet, put it on, tied it with my teeth in my hand, stopped the bleeding, and immediately checked on my two guys who got minor shrapnel. In fact, they both went out on missions the next day and stayed in the military for some time longer. But once I saw they were okay, one of my first sergeants comes running up to me and he grabs me by my shoulder, by my kit, and he's attempting to pick me up and say, come on, we're going to get you out of here. And I kind of pushed his arm and I said, you're not taking me anywhere. Not till you kill those SOBs behind the building and stop the volume of fire they're putting down on us. He saw that I was coherent. I had already started doing self-aid. And the best thing he could do was take out the enemy that and stop them from firing on us. So he took off to go flank. At that point, when he left, there was another lull in fire. I don't know if they ran low on ammo or what it was, but I was able to grab onto another guy, and we ran out of there till we got to our casualty collection point.
And that sounds like a pretty good spot to take our final break. Are you imagining yourself in this Medal of Honor recipient's boots? What a gripping story from Leroy Petrie, and we'll hear the rest of it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.